Welcome to American History Untucked. I'm your host, David Silkenet. This is our 10th episode, which I guess isn't much of a milestone for most podcasts, but I'm actually quite surprised that we made it this far in as little time as we have. I started this podcast a few months ago with the intention of recording a few episodes and seeing where it headed, and I've been very impressed and surprised with the response thus far. My guest for this episode is Rachel Hope Cleaves, who is a professor at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. She is the author of two books, The Reign of Terror in America, which came out in 2009, and most recently, Charity and Sylvia, A Same-Sex Marriage in Early America. In our conversation, we talk about both books, and we talk about some experiences she had in college that helped to shape her interest in violence, which led to her first book, and some of the research that went into her most recent book, on Charity and Sylvia. We began our conversation, though, with Rachel asking me about the origins of the podcast. And as this is our 10th episode, that sounds like a good place to start. So here's my conversation with Rachel Hope Cleaves.
Curious how you got into the idea of podcasting.
I guess I had just started the position here at Edinburgh this year.
Okay.
And I was feeling in some ways disconnected from the rest of the academic world in a way. I guess the notion does that. Mm-hmm. And I was looking for sort of ways to connect with people, because I wasn't going to go to as many conferences. I wasn't going to run into people accidentally as often. So that's sort of part of it. The other part of it was that, there are a bunch of history podcasts out there, but they tend to be very much about the stuff and not so much about the people doing the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought there was a sort of a space for a conversation about how historians do history and what it is that we do.
Mm-hmm.
And why it is we do and what motivates us and how we sort of think.
That's a great idea.
So, I mean, I guess I was, I listen to lots of podcasts because I'm occasionally antisocial. And I think I was in the grocery store here and I was listening to Backstory. Do you listen to podcasts a lot?
I listen to some.
Okay.
I listen to Mark Maron.
So the other person I was listening to, I was listening to Backstory, which is a very sort of well, highly produced podcast done by some historians in Virginia, but it's very NPR-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was listening to sort of Mark Maron sort of right afterwards, and it struck me that there was an intersection between those things that somebody wasn't doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether I'm actually doing that or not, but at least that was part of the sort of goal of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of course, Mark Maron does get very deeply personal.
Yeah, and I'm not quite sure I'm skilled enough to do that, nor do I think that most historians are as they're not as comfortable with the devastating childhood anecdote as most comedians are, because that's part of how
exactly
lots of historians do what they do. Comedians are certainly, I guess, used to those kinds of conversations. Historians are, less so. But
not just that. I actually think I just read some new study that found that historians were less likely to use the first person in their writing than any other discipline, just about. So, I mean, I think there's such a powerful injunction against autobiographical, references in the discipline, which I've broken before. So,
well, I noticed that, I think it was the first, maybe one of the first things you published when you were in grad school, was a piece in the Journal of the Early Republic on violence.
That is true. Are we officially...
If you would like us to be, we can be.
Okay, we can be, because that is... Because I'd be happy to talk about that, but that is specifically about the historical and the process.
Sure.
Yeah, the first piece I ever published was... I published during graduate school, and it came out of a conference paper for a conference organized by Jim Downs and Jen Mannion called Why We Write.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a conference oriented towards, I guess, bridging activism and the academy. And I wrote this piece about my experiences as the victim of a school shooting. Not that I was myself shot, but present at a school shooting. And how that had influenced my own historical inquiries into the history of American attitudes towards physical violence. And I did get blowback from that article. Although it was published, some of the readers' reports were less than kind about my attempt to integrate my own story with my historical story. And one of my anonymous readers said that it was appropriate for David Brian Davis, who I don't know if you ever read his famous piece about his experiences in World War II,
mm-hmm.
and how they influenced his own inquiry into the history of slavery. But for anyone who's listening to this who hasn't read this piece by David Brian Davis, you know, this was a piece that was written by obviously an incredibly senior historian towards the end of his career, reflecting, not that his career is over yet, but late in his career, I should say, reflecting back on the experiences in his youth. And so my reader report said something along the lines of, it's fine for...
He can do that, and you may be able to do that in 20 years,
no,
maybe.
40 years.
40 years.
But it's fine for a man in his 70s, but not for a woman in her 20s. That was a very clear reaction I got. But other people have appreciated the article. So, but it was divisive.
So for those people who haven't been keeping up with the Journal of the Early Republic reading, the article does some interesting things. I think simply with the font and with the text that it alternates between. The story of violence in the early Republic, which is in fairly standard academic kind of prose, their normal font, and then it switches to, I guess, to italics for the half of the article where you're speaking more personally about your experience in the school shooting.
Mm-hmm.
So for those people who haven't read the article, could you tell us the part of the story about the school shooting and then the part of the story about the early Republic?
So I think that writing experiment, just to begin, came out of my initial desire when I entered graduate school to approach writing history as a creative discipline and as a form of creative nonfiction. And to experiment with ways of writing. And that article was my first and for a long time only stab at that.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I got disciplined out of it pretty quickly. But the school shooting I write about in the article took place when I was a sophomore at Simon's Rock College of Bard, which is now called Simon's Rock at Bard College, or I can't remember. It changed its name since I went there. But Simon's Rock is a college in Western Massachusetts that accepts students directly out of 10th and 11th grade. It was a very small liberal arts college, around fewer than 300 students when I was there.
And so you went there right out of 10th grade then?
Went there right out of 10th grade. Yes, I was a very unhappy student. I was not a big fan of school as I was growing up. And... So in December of my sophomore year, which was December of 1992, one of my classmates bought a semi-automatic rifle and went through campus shooting. I was on campus at the time, and he was someone I knew, as I knew the victims, because it was such a small community, and he murdered My teacher that semester, Nakanyon Saez, and he murdered a friend of mine named Galen Gibson, whose father has written a memoir about his experiences of dealing with Galen's death. And he wounded four more people and shot at friends of mine before his gun jammed. And he was arrested, and he's serving a life imprisonment term in Massachusetts now. And, the experience, I guess I was 16, I was about to turn 17. It was the day before my 17th birthday. And the experience was shattering, of course, and it had an enormous influence on the course of my life, I think, and on my initial historical interests. So when I was in graduate school, I was attracted to history as a discipline because I was really interested in writing, and I'd taken a course in historical writing with Simon Shama, and I'd gotten very excited about the different possibilities for creative approaches to historical writing, and that's what had drawn me into graduate school more than any specific interest in a historical moment or time. And
But why didn't you go into some other kind of writing or into journalism or into fiction writing? What was it that drove you to apply to history programs?
I loved the challenge of writing history in particular. So as a kid, I'd always wanted to be a fiction writer. I'd always wanted to be a novelist. And I'm a big reader. I was a classic bookworm. And I love literature, and I still love literature, but I never loved literary criticism. And writing fiction is extremely challenging. And one of the things I found challenging about it was how wide open it was. And the first time I started writing history, when I took this history writing course with Simon Shaman, I had this challenge of taking a discrete set of pieces, of evidence, and constructing a narrative only out of what you have. That boundedness to it, the puzzle of linking together discrete pieces of evidence and going no further and yet creating narrative out of them. I just found that puzzle extremely engrossing and challenging. In some ways, I think it held a similar attraction for me that writing poetry can hold for people, where when you're
The
writing,
form binds you in a way.
exactly, the form binds you. And so there's this challenge portion. It's a logic puzzle, and I fell in love with that puzzle for history, and I was deeply curious about the past, I guess. So it all came together for me. I also had a practical side, that a little voice in my ear saying that it was going to be really tough to make a living as a novelist. But
Whereas a historian is a much easier living.
well, that, I maybe wasn't that well informed. I thought, oh, as an academic, it's going to be ideal for work-life balance, and I'll find a job and I'll get paid a salary in order to sit around and read and write. And actually, it's turned out pretty well for me. I understand that it doesn't always work out that well, but I've been very lucky.
And so you go to graduate school, you're not quite exactly sure what kind of history you wanted to study. How did you end up with, I guess, what was your dissertation that became your first book?
Right. So I wasn't sure. I knew I wanted to do American history. I had spent a few years in between my first years of college at Simon's Rock and finishing college at Barnard College in New York. I spent a couple years in between traveling around the country, and I have visited 48 of the states, I think, at this point. So I
Ooh, I'm
visited.
just behind you. I'm at 47.
You have 47. I think I've missed Alaska for certain. No, I have not been there, but I believe I have not been to Missouri.
I have not. I've also missed Alaska, and I think I've missed Washington and Oregon.
Oh, well, you have to come to Washington and
Washington, yeah.
Oregon for one.
I know. It's on my list of things to do, although they're somewhat further away now than they used to be.
Yes, you're right. It's not bad from North Dakota.
Yeah, but
So I was interested in American history. I was an American studies major as an undergraduate, but then I had discovered my love of history towards the end of my time in college. And so I came in knowing I wanted to do American history. And I think I was always compelled by earlier American history because I like that sense of the past as a foreign country. So I liked the unfamiliar aspects of history more than the familiar. And then I developed a academic interest in the history of violence, and that piece really came from my experience with the school shooting at Simon's Rock and the both kind of morbidity it inspired in me for years afterwards, and my observations of the United States is clearly exceptional rates of homicide.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious where that came from. And I launched the dissertation project with a very simple question, which was, how did Americans react to the violence of the Reign of Terror coming so soon on the heels of the American Revolution and the origins of the United States as a nation? And I thought that would be the first chapter of my dissertation. And so I researched, and I wrote chapter one, which was about 90 pages or something. And I gave it to my dissertation committee, and my dissertation committee said to me, "I don't think this is one chapter."
It sounds like three chapters and probably five chapters.
I think it was five. Yeah. And so I broke it up and did some more research, and that became the dissertation.
So how do you think that your experience at Simon's Rock then shaped the way you looked at violence and the way in which you saw violence differently than other people who had looked at violence in the early Republic?
I think that for me, I think the biggest distinction for me was that my experience at Simon's Rock led me to feel that violence was a predictable human behavior, a predictable outcome. Mm. It was normal and not exceptional. And so I ended up with a kind of surprising sympathy with these conservative political and religious figures of the early Republic who haven't always been treated that kindly in the historiography, the Federalists and the Standing Order of the Congregationalist Church, who worried a lot about human violence because they saw it as a to be expected behavior of humanity, of a corrupt humanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
That man is a wolf to man, and that men were given to violence unless otherwise restrained.
Yeah.
And while I don't at all share the religious perspective of my of the Congregationalist Standing Order of my sources, and I don't share the political perspective of the Federalists I wrote about, I was able to empathize with their concerns that human violence was always a threat unless prevented, in a way that I think a lot of my fellow historians didn't feel.
Yeah.
So,
well, I guess the dominant culture now tells us today that people who commit acts of violence are different from everybody else in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rather than being just like us who have had unfortunate circumstances push them to violence.
Yeah, right. Which Karen Haltunen talks about that in Murder Most Foul. I mean, I think it's a really interesting shift that's been, that took place in the United States probably in the 19th century. But this, right, the shift from viewing, humanity as corrupt and given to violence to more good and violence being the exception.
Yeah. Well, it sort of speaks to the whole lie, the NRA line about the only thing that stops a bad person with a gun is a good person with a gun, and therefore we should give good people guns, is that the distinction between a good person and a bad person isn't always as abundantly clear.
The NRA would suggest, right? And I mean, I think that if you read execution sermons from colonial America, you would find a much more normalized view of human violence, right? That we all share this capacity. I don't necessarily share the Puritan's point of view, but
few of us do.
Their argument is that that there's not a yawning gulf between acts of homicide and the ordinary sinfulness of Sabbath breaking and blaspheming and the crimes of daily life, right? And that there's a clear road that you don't have to be a monster to commit murder.
So this is the first book is a very different book than your book that just came out in all kinds of ways. There isn't a whole lot of violence and shooting in the or at least talk of shooting in your most recent book, Charity and Sylvia, which I just finished. I think is a wonderful book.
Thank you.
How did you find the story of these two women?
It was a wonderful and fortuitous tale, and it actually begins with my dissertation, curiously enough. So the dissertation and the first book, which is called The Reign of Terror in America, ends with a chapter that looks at how the children of the Federalists and Orthodox Congregationalist ministry of the 1790s and first decade of the 19th century, how the children of that generation became the abolitionists of the antebellum era. And it also traces the continuance of the rhetoric about the French Revolution and about the terror into the antebellum era and into the Civil War. So I was doing this sort of prosopography about this generation of the second generation of children. And one of the figures I looked at was William Cullen Bryant, who was the son of a Federalist state politician in Massachusetts and a doctor, and had himself in some of his earliest poems were anti-Jacobin in their nature, or anti-Napoleonic at least. He had been, before he was persuaded to the to Jacksonian democracy in his adolescence, he'd been a young Federalist. Anyway, so William Cullen Bryant had gone on to become the editor of the New York Evening Post and one of the most famous poets in 19th century America, and a very strong voice against slavery and one of the early founders of the Republican Party and Republican political appointee during the Civil War and all the rest. And so I was reading a 19th century biography of William Cullen Bryant by his son-in-law, and it included all of these letters written by William Cullen Bryant, which is pretty typical for 19th century biography. And I came across this letter he wrote describing his two aunts who lived together in a marriage in Vermont. And it's beautifully described. And as I was reading it, I thought to myself, wow, I have never read of a same-sex relationship in the early national era before that's described so explicitly as a marriage. Mm-hmm. And that was really what interested me from the outset, was that it wasn't just an account of a lesbian relationship, but of a lesbian relationship that was understood by the people of the time as being marital. And so I thought to myself, it would be great to see if there are any sources that were left by these women. And I went online. I think I went to Archive Grid or whatever it was. This was 2005, I think. And two hits come up. And the first one was this local history museum in Middlebury, Vermont, where, as coincidence would have it, I had visited 6 months earlier or so. I had gone camping for a week in Vermont with my husband and my son and some friends. And anyway, we stepped into this museum in Middlebury, and I said, you know, places like this have, you don't even know what treasures are in the.
Yeah, there's lots of these little county museums have all kinds of things that there's no one's looked at.
Wonderful things in the archives here, and who even knows what they are? So that was where the largest collection of original documents related to Charity and Sylvia's lives were archived. And then the second place that they were archived, that there was a large archival collection that I found initially, was in the Regional History Center at the Library of Northern Illinois University, where I had only weeks before accepted my first job.
That's convenient.
Yes, yeah, so that it was this like extraordinary kismet experience. You know, I really felt like the strings were being pulled, and it just seemed unquestionable that that would have to be my next research project. And so, you know, for the next several years, I was working on turning my dissertation into a book, but I was also working whenever I could on Charity and Sylvia. And as I pursued the project, I found lots of other sources and lots of other places. But that's how I came across the story.
And so for those people who haven't had a chance to read the book yet, these two women had a relationship that lasted, I think, what was it, 44 years.
Mm-hmm.
They were treated in large part by their community, you know, as a married couple, and they were, you know, described that way. In some ways, it seems very, you know, it seems very modern. It doesn't seem like the kind of story we would think an early 19th century couple, the way their relationship would unfold. What surprised you most about trying to piece together their story?
There were a lot of surprises in piecing together the story. First of all, there was a great surprise, a wonderful surprise to me, in the richness of the sources that I was able to find. I never expected to find so many sources in so many places that would give me access to such detail about the women's daily lives, about their internal experiences, their subjectivities. I continue to be amazed by what turned up, you know, what had been preserved from their lives together. I think that in terms of the actual story, the main surprise, as you say, is really that same-sex marriage could exist as such in the early 19th century. That came as a, and now I guess I'm so used to making this argument that it ceased to be surprising to me in a way. But that was the initial surprise that launched the project, and I think that's the biggest surprise to, or will be the biggest surprise to most people who read the book, that that within a, so Charity Bryant and Sylvia Drake, the two women I write about, and Charity and Bryant were both born in the Revolutionary era, Charity in 1777 and Sylvia in 1784. And they made their lives together from 1807 to 1851 in a very small rural frontier community in western Vermont. And the community they lived in was, you know, dominated by traditional family networks, the church, and it was a very orthodox frontier community. And what surprised me the most was to find how they were able to find a place within that community to establish a union that people regarded as either a marriage or something like it.
Which, you know, that's very different than the way in which we usually sort of narrate LGBT history. It's usually located in cities, and that people, gay people, come from rural religious parts of the country to New York or San Francisco or wherever, you know, to find each other. So it's a very different kind of story than the stories, at least that we used to tell about the queer past, until fairly recently, I think.
That's absolutely right. And I think that one of the reasons why LGBT history has focused on the city as the site of the formation of LGBT communities and identities, and focused on the city as a place where people could live open queer lives, is because the majority of LGBT history has focused on the history of men.
Mm.
And I actually think that, there's a lot of grouping that's being done and bringing together lesbian and gay and bisexual and transgender histories, right? And those are different histories. They can be different histories. And I think that if you look at the history of women and same-sex attractions, same-sex relations between women in American history, I think you find that the countryside is much more imagined as the space where those relationships can take place, can happen, that there's this dream that Cherry and Sylvia took part in, but weren't the only exemplars of. There's this dream of, you know, retiring to your cottage in the Vale, you know, in a valley, right? To finding your space in a rural community. And not only do I think that LGBT history has focused so much on the city because it's attended more towards male wage earners than women. And for a lot of women, at least up into the 20th century, there's not a lot of, going to the city as a wage worker is not a great fantasy. I mean, wage working opportunities for women in the city were often pretty terrible.
Mm-hmm.
and not particularly liberating. Not only do I think that there's a gendered dimension to why this is a rural story, actually, I think that is a bias, a modern bias against, and a modern urban bias on the part of historians against rural settings as a space where dissident practices can and do take place. So I think that there's just been a lack of understanding about the way that the closet functions and the way in which the closet enables the emergence of a different sort of queer life and queer culture in the country. But there is some great work that has come out about LGBT, you know, LGBT rural history. I mean, there's a new book about LGBT history in Arkansas, right? Queer state.
Mm-hmm.
And
I first got interested in gay history, I guess it was in 94. I was living in New York City at the time, and there was the 25th anniversary of Stonewall. And I guess they had the gay games as well in New York, and so it was a sort of pivotal time. And I don't know whether you were in New York at the time, but there was a sort of visibility to gay history more than there had been prior to that. And I remember trying to sort of dig back before 1969 and I couldn't really find very much. The gay history sort of started in the 1950s in some ways, and in the 20 years since then, it seems that there's been a sort of an explosion in the amount of scholarship on gay history throughout the 20th century, and with the case of your book, going into the 19th and 18th centuries.
Yeah. Thomas Foster edited a collection of essays about early American same-sex intimacies a few years ago, and John D'Amelio wrote a preface for it where he admits kind of embarrassedly that colonial America is something you just have to skip through as an LGBT historian. You know, when you're teaching a class in LGBT history, it's basically just an inconvenience that has to be, you know, swept out of the way so you can get on to the good stuff. And I think that if you look at syllabuses for classes in LGBT history that are being taught, CLAGS has a great website where people put up sample syllabuses. Very few of them spend more than a week or two in the 18th and 19th, 17th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
I hope there's a sea change coming. I think that long before Stonewall was part of it, I hope that Charity and Sylvia contributes to it. I have to say that in doing the research for Charity and Sylvia, I really became persuaded that the post-revolutionary period, the 1790s and the early 19th century, was a time in which sexual possibilities very much expanded for American youth.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things your book demonstrates is that the explanation people always gave for why there wasn't LGBT history prior to 1900 or whenever was that there weren't any sources. To be sure, they said there would be gay people, but you wouldn't have sources to document it. And I think one of the things your book does an excellent job of is demonstrating, in some ways, a very normal couple. And I don't know whether I'm using the word normal there in with any degree of specificity, but they seem very, I guess, normal. You know, they don't seem as revolutionary as one might expect a gay couple in the early 19th century to be treated.
They're not outlaws in any sense, but the fact that they choose to marry each other rather than to marry men, which of course is an extremely significant breaking of norms.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that Charity and Sylvia's story is a story about how through upholding social norms in all sorts of ways and by contributing to the community, they were able to carve a space for a relationship that broke one of the central rules of their society. And that balancing that took extreme effort. It was a real struggle.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't easy for them to create that life together. It wasn't easy for them to gain acceptance or toleration by their family and friends. It was a process that developed over decades. And I really feel like it was only towards the end of their lives, you know, maybe by the 1830s when the generation of nieces and nephews who had grown up only knowing their family as having these two aunts, you know, living in this marital relationship. It was really only when that next generation had become adults that I think Cherry and Sylvia really achieved this kind of status as venerated women in the family and community.
And one of the things you talk about in the book is that there's something, they have sort of an open closet, you know, that they're, everybody knows they're a couple, but everyone sort of ignores that they're a couple simultaneously. That their coupleness is very apparent, but their sexuality is in some ways very invisible.
Yes, and I absolutely think that that the way in which the closet function in Charity and Sylvia's life applies more broadly to the function of the closet. It in many times and places in American history and into today, that what we don't know, we often choose not to know.
Mm-hmm.
So that ignorance is something that we construct rather than an actual absence of knowledge. And that Charity and Sylvia's life was made viable, their role in their community was made viable by their neighbors and family members and friends' refusal to ask the question of what, whether or what sort of physical relationship the women had. So there was, you know, there was an agreed upon ignorance. And that is, of course, an incredibly vulnerable position for people to be in, because it means that at any moment, the sanction for your relationship can be revoked.
Sure.
You know, if you step outside of the boundaries in some other way, if you're causing trouble in some other way, if you get into a dispute over property, if you get into a dispute over religion, if you get into any of the many different, you know, venues for dispute that made rural communities often very fractious places in early American history.
Well, just like gay couples today, if you don't have the legal sanction of marriage, you know, you have all these technical disadvantages that can be overwhelming in times of crisis.
Right. I mean, I think that that is what is most important, or one of the most important distinctions between same-sex marriage as it's now developing as a legal right in the United States and the history of same-sex marriage. So one of my goals in the book is to argue that same-sex marriages did exist in the early 19th century, you know, or any, you know, throughout the 19th century into the 20th century. And that some of them, depending on how you understand the history of common law marriage, may even have had a certain legal force. However, they were extremely vulnerable, then they weren't a legal right.
Mm-hmm.
And they were extremely dependent on the couple's conformity to other social dictates, right? And that what the creation of same-sex marriage as a legal right today is doing is to take away that vulnerability, to liberate same-sex couples to be as, you know, badly behaved as everybody else. That's not quite right, but...
Well, in some way, you know, among other things, yes. So you're in Paris at the moment?
I am in Paris.
So what has brought you to Paris?
My very first sabbatical.
Congratulations.
Yeah, very exciting.
So how long have you been there?
We came in August.
And how long do you get to stay?
Till the end of June.
All right, and what project are you... That's a long time. Okay.
It is.
So what are you going to be doing for that?
So I've been working on a new project about, it's shifted and morphed throughout my time here. Initially, I was thinking about writing about Americans learning to cook in Paris over the course of a few centuries. And I'd had this joke for a long time that I wrote my first book about violence and my second book about sex, and I wanted to write my third book about food and cover all the essential life functions.
That's great.
So that's how I started out. But then I kept, as I was doing the research, I kept finding sex in all my sources about food. And I started off by thinking that that was just my preoccupation as a historian of sexuality. But I've since changed my tune, and I actually think that there's a besides my own preoccupations. And so the project has turned into a history of pursuits of pleasure within expatriate communities. And I want to go beyond Americans in Paris to a variety of strangers abroad in the 19th and 20th centuries. And in some ways, I think that the Charity and Sylvia Project was, I mean, it was a very unqueer project in a way, right? It was about a same-sex marriage, which we haven't talked about in this interview, but of course there's all sorts of critiques from the left of the homonormativity of same-sex marriage. And and I think that this is a much more queer project. I'm less interested in looking at one distinct community, lesbians in Paris or whomever, or one distinct sexual practice. I'm interested in blurring boundaries and looking at the range of kind of practices of pleasure that brought together communities of outsiders. And so those are both a variety of dissident sexual practices.
And food.
And also other pleasures of the body, including, the pleasure of the table, and also heavy drinking, hard drugs, and excessive sociability. So,
well, I hope you get a chance to sample at least some of those in Paris, and which ones I'll leave to your discretion. I have one final question for you, and it's a question that's purely for my own interest. You teach at the University of Victoria when you're not gallivanting in Paris.
That's true.
And I've just finished my first year teaching outside of the United States. How do you teach American history differently in Canada than you do when you were teaching in Illinois?
It's a big difference, isn't it? Is that what you're finding?
Well, I'm parts of it I find very different, but the things I find different are more the questions the students ask than the kinds of things that I'm putting forward. So we have lots of American students here, and many of them actually take American history because they want to get American history from a different perspective. And quite honestly, I think my lectures are not all that radically different. The lectures of my colleagues aren't all that different than what we get in the States. I'm seeing subtle things in what students talk about in smaller questions and the questions they ask. But I'm still sort of pondering over how you teach American history outside of the United States, because it's something I'm sort of been wrestling with over the past year.
So I've thought a lot about this, and I've had a lot of conversations about this with my fellow Americanist at UVic, Jason Colby, who also taught in the U.S. before coming to teach at UVic. And I would say that for me, before I came to UVic, I taught at a state school in Illinois. And most of the students came out of the public school system in Illinois. And there's many great high school history teachers, of course, but I think the standard narrative that my students brought to the classroom was a patriotic narrative, right? Mm-hmm. It was a nation-building narrative that forms the basis of the curriculum in the state of Illinois. And so a lot of my work, especially at the survey level, was about myth-busting.
Yeah.
And it's, coming from the beginning, deflating myths about Christopher Columbus, right? I have two children, and my son was in public school in Illinois before we came to Victoria, and I remember him doing an assignment in first grade or so about Johnny Appleseed and how, in the words of his worksheet, Johnny Appleseed was friends to all the Indians and animals.
So I think that's from a song from like the 50s or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so there was a lot of myth busting to do. Teaching to students in British Columbia, there's no need to bust those myths for all sorts of reasons. First of all, Canadian students don't, at least in BC, where again I'm teaching students who are mostly educated in the public school system in British Columbia, the public education system doesn't offer American history. So my students typically come into the survey having only studied American history during their unit on World War II.
Hmm.
You know, some, I think World War II and the post-war era of the United States enters into the Canadian history curriculum. But a lot of my students really don't share those myths which are inculcated into public school students in the United States. And to the extent that they do have ideas about the U.S. and U.S. history, they're often quite negative. Obviously, B.C. had a huge influx, at least where I live, of draft dodgers and other critics of American imperialism. And
these are the kids.
Yeah, and the kids, well, not all of them, of course, only some, only a few. But I think there's a lot more of Canadian identity is constructed around its distinction from the U.S. And, you know, whereas the U.S. was imperialist somehow, Canada was not. Which, you know, so now I have to bust a different set of myths.
Sure.
By gently suggesting that Canada may have engaged in imperialism as well in order to conquer such a vast landmass.
Yeah, that's what I'm wrestling with is that I think lots of my sort of narrative tropes when I taught in the States were about, here's what you thought happened and let's deconstruct the sort of mythology of things. And the students here don't have that mythology to deconstruct. That sort of pedagogical tool is out the window.
Yes. Yes.
You know, or the sort of the pop culture things that I expect them to know that they don't know. And they also don't have graham crackers here, so I can't talk about Sylvester Graham and sexuality in the same way and have them horrified at the childhood when I tell them what graham crackers are really for. I tried to do that here, and they'd never heard of what a graham cracker was.
But, you know, that I think is also the story of teaching and is slowly diverging from your students' generations, right? Mm-hmm. That is a process that is inevitable, I think. I mean, the farther away we get from the age of our students, the less and less our references make sense to them.
To be sure.
It's just along by changing.
We're all getting old and we're going to die. Okay.
But yeah, no, it's an interesting project. But now I do find myself having to sometimes try and persuade my students that, like, well, the concept of liberty did have salience in American history, you know, which is not something I would have had to persuade most of my students in Illinois.
Yeah.
It's not just a word. It had meaning.
Yeah. Well, the thing my students still can't figure out here is Americans' obsessions with guns, but I haven't figured that one out either.
Nor I.
Well, Rachel, it was really great talking with you, and thank you for taking some time away from your experience in Paris to talk with me.
Oh, and I wanted to say, if anyone is interested in the new project, I've been blogging this year.
Okay, so, you want to pitch? Give everyone the blog site, and I'll put it on the website too.
It's rachelhopecleaves.com. So it's just my name. And I've been trying, just like with the podcast, I'm actually trying to communicate with people, which is something that we as academic historians don't always do a great job at. But the blog is not very academical.
It's got lots of food pictures too.
It's got lots of pictures of food and you know, interesting folk from the past whom I've run across.
Right,
thank you so much for inviting me to take part in this podcast, David. It's been a
pleasure. Thanks a lot. It was great talking with you.
All right. Goodbye.
So that was my conversation with Rachel Hope Cleaves. As always, you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. The show page is AmericanHistoryUntucked.blogspot.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and we're now also on Stitcher if you'd like to subscribe there. Until next time, I'm David Zilkinet.